In 2002, the United States Department of Energy was faced with a difficult and fascinating challenge. It had proposed storing radioactive material inside the Yucca Mountain in Nevada, but because this material would remain extremely dangerous for at least 10,000 years, and some suggested maybe even up to 1 million years, the Environmental Protection Agency required that a warning sign be placed on the site that would remain meaningful and intelligible for that entire time. But how is this possible? What sign could possibly fill such a role? What sign could be meaningful and intelligible for thousands and perhaps even up to 1 million years? Will the English language be understood then? Will any mode of communication that is familiar to us still be meaningful at that time? So the University of Nevada sponsored a design competition, inviting artists from all over the world to submit suggestions for an exhibit entitled, quote, Universal Warning Sign, Yucca Mountain. The winning entry proposed, and I don't claim that I really understand this, the winning entry proposed engineering a kind of a cacti that would glow cobalt blue in varying levels of intensity depending on the radiation level. Somehow it was suggested that this would alert visitors to the site in 10,000 or maybe even 1 million years from now to the dangers that potentially awaited them. The challenge posed by the need to dispose of nuclear toxins is new, but the desire to convey messages from generation to generation, designed to pass the test of time, has always been part of the human enterprise. Human beings have always been invested in finding ways to convey information to those who will come after them, to construct messages that will make sense to those to whom those messages will be directed, to enable them to remember what their ancestors experienced and the values by which those ancestors lived their lives. There is no doubt that of all peoples, memory is central to Jews and Judaism. At the beginning of his justifiably celebrated work entitled Zachor and subtitled Jewish History and Jewish Memory, my late teacher and professor Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi wrote the following: only in Israel and nowhere else is the injunction to remember felt as a religious imperative to an entire people. Its reverberations are everywhere. Jews become a nation because from the biblical period and on, Jews are rooted in memory. Earlier in the book, Professor Yerushalmi noted that the Hebrew word zachor, in Hebrew zayin chaf resh, appears in its various declensions no less than 169 times in the Hebrew Bible. Memory is an essential feature of Jewishness. Jews are a people of memory. What makes us a people is that we remember what happened to our ancestors, and we pass that memory on to those who will follow us. At some point in the Middle Ages, Kabbalists formulated what is known as the Six Remembrances. Text number 2. The Six Remembrances were designed to be recited after the morning service every single day. Let's take a look at what these remembrances are. We're now establishing, institutionalizing, formalizing memory as part of the daily liturgical service. The Exodus from Egypt, and each one of them has a verse. Each one of them is based on a verse in the Bible, which requires that these events be remembered. The exodus from Egypt, the revelation at Mount Sinai, the terrible event of Amalek when this nation attacked the Jewish people after we had left Egypt, the golden calf, the sin of the Jews at the golden calf, and the general anger of God against us in the desert. Miriam spoke ill of her brother and she was punished for it, and the Shabbat. These six remembrances, once again based on rooted in biblical texts, are considered to be so important that they made their way into the daily prayer book. Most people I know do not recite them, but they're there, and the fact that they're there and the fact that some people do recite them highlights their significance. As I begin this lecture series on the Jewish meaning of memory, the question that I want to pose is as follows. How can a person remember an event that she or he never experienced? How can the word remember in the sentence, remember the Exodus from Egypt, be the same remember as the word remember in the sentence, I remember what I ate for breakfast? I ate breakfast. I remember what I ate for breakfast. I did not participate in the Exodus from Egypt. How can I remember? How can I be required to remember the Exodus from Egypt? I wasn't there. I didn't experience it. I want to suggest first that the obligation to remember in Judaism, and this is, remember that this is, of course, about remembering, the obligation to remember in Judaism, as in these six remembrances and others, needs to be seen and understood and appreciated in national or collective terms. The focus of this series is not the Jewish meaning of personal memory, but the Jewish meaning of national memory. What is national memory? The first one to systematically discuss this, the notion of collective memory, historical memory, national memory, was Maurice Halbwachs. We're now in text number 3. Halbwachs was a French sociologist and philosopher. Just a brief little biographical word about him. He was a Catholic who was married to a Jewish woman. In 1944, he's living in France. His Jewish father-in-law was arrested in Lyon and murdered by the French Nazis. Halbwachs rushed to the local Gestapo headquarters to protest, at which point he was imprisoned and sent to the Buchenwald concentration camp. He was murdered, we know exactly, on March 16, 1945, less than a month before the Buchenwald concentration camp was liberated by Allied forces on April 11. Halbwachs's groundbreaking work is summarized here in text number 3 by Jeffrey Olick. Halbwachs thus distinguished, text number 3, between, quote, autobiographical memory and, quote, historical memory. The former, namely autobiographical memory, concerns the events of one's own life that one remembers because they were experienced directly. I remember what I ate for breakfast. Though it also includes reference to events which one did not experience directly, but around which one's memory is oriented. So, for example, you are likely to remember what you were doing when an event designated historic by the group took place, such as the attacks of 9/11. We all remember where we were on 9/11 when we heard the news. Even if these events did not affect you directly in your individuality, rather than in terms of the group of which you are a member. There are some of us who are sitting here this morning who might go a little bit further back and say, well, I remember where I was exactly when I heard of JFK assassination. So there are events that we experience, even though it wasn't a personal experience, there are events that we experience, but it's us, we experience them, and that's called, Halbwachs says, autobiographical memory. Historical memory, or collective memory, or national memory in distinction, refers to residues of events by virtue of which groups claim a continuous identity through time. Very relevant to Jews, very relevant to this lecture series. Quote, historical memory of the U.S. Civil War, for instance, is part of what it means to be an American, and is part of the collective narrative of the United States. But nobody who's alive today still has autobiographical memory of that event. Autobiographical memory, or personal memory, is the memory of events that we ourselves personally experienced. Historical memory, by contrast, collective memory, group memory, social memory, national memory, is a memory of events that define us as a group, like, for instance, the six remembrances, the Exodus from Egypt, the revelation at Mount Sinai, the battle with Amalek, and so on. But the question still remains, how is it possible for an American born after 1865 to remember the Civil War? How is it possible for a Jew born in the desert or any time thereafter, including us, to remember the Exodus from Egypt? Okay, so it's national memory. But what does that mean? I remember. What does it mean? I nationally remember. How can I remember anything if I didn't experience it? What is at stake here for Jews is not just that the memory is some kind of a civic duty, that as a nation, it's appropriate for us to identify ourselves with those who left Egypt, our ancestors, but it's actually a positive biblical commandment. In Hebrew, a mitzvat aseh. There's an obligation to remember. So in order to fulfill this obligation, I have to remember. But how can I remember? I can't remember because I was never there. I want to suggest that the Hebrew root zachor, in Hebrew zayin chaf resh, is not to be understood by what we commonly associate in English to mean to remember. I believe that this Hebrew root means to draw one's attention to place at the forefront of one's consciousness. When the Bible requires six remembrances, and there are others as well that are thrown into this mix, they're not requiring that we remember. And what defines us as a people is not that we remember in the common sense of remembering. What it means is, make this important to you. Place this event at the forefront of your consciousness. And my proof comes from remembering the Sabbath, the Shabbat, which is the last of the six remembrances that I just read to you. Text number four, the Bible says, remember the Sabbath day to sanctify it. Remember the Sabbath day to sanctify it. What do you mean, remember the Sabbath day? Was the Sabbath an event that I should remember? And how can I remember? The common understanding of the word remember doesn't make any sense at all in this context. And this context sheds light on all the other contexts. Rashi, in his commentary, right below in text number four, says this explicitly. Commenting on the word remember, zachor, Rashi comments, pay attention to always remember the day of Shabbat, so that if you will come upon an attractive object, prepare it for Shabbat. The reference here is to a Talmudic text right below in text number five. They said about Shammai the elder that every day he would eat in honor of the Shabbat. How so? If he came across a superior animal anytime during the week, he would say, ah, you know what? Shabbat is coming. I'm not going to eat it today. I'm going to wait for Shabbat. Then let's say at some point later on in the week, he comes across a more superior food. Then he'll say, you know what? I can eat the old one because this is even better. I'll save this one for Shabbat. So what does it mean to remember the Shabbat? It means to place it at the forefront of our consciousness, to think about it all the time. Rashi uses the phrase, pay attention to remember the Shabbat. Now, if one still insists on associating this remember to the classical English standard definition of the word remember, I would suggest the following formulation. It does not mean remember an event that happened. I can't remember that event. It does not mean remember an event that happened, but it means remember that an event happened. It's a world of difference between these two formulations. It's not remember the event that happened, but remember that an event happened. Remember doesn't mean remember in the standard sense. It means recognize this. This is significant to you. Internalize this, that this event happened. But how do I do this? What is the mechanism for the transmission or the internalization of historical memory, cultural memory, social memory, national memory? How does this happen? And this is crucially important for this lecture series. Rabbinic sources make it clear that thought alone is never sufficient. So what do we associate with remember? I close my eyes and there's something going on in my mind and I'm remembering. That alone cannot be what remember is in this context. One cannot just be told to think something, but we're told to say something. We have to articulate something. We have to verbalize something. And furthermore, it's not enough to just verbalize something, but we actually have to do something. There's an action that's associated with memory. There are a number of stages here. It's not passive. In my head, I close my eyes. I'm engaged in the act of remembering. No, I have to say something. No, it's not even just say something. I actually have to do something. How do we remember the Exodus? It's not just we think about the Exodus. It's not even just that we describe the Exodus on the night of Passover when we do a lot of talking, but we do things. So we eat the matzah. We eat the maror. We drink 4 cups of wine. We do things in order for us to, quote, remember. So memory requires activity. This course will focus on one specific kind of Jewish national, social, or collective memory, and that is the memory of tragedy and the memory of suffering. Thank God this has not been the totality of the Jewish historical experience. We do not espouse what is normally associated with the phrase, the lachrymose conception of Jewish history, that it was all awful and terrible and sad and miserable. Ours is not, thank God, a history of pogroms and persecution. If that's all there was in Jewish history, we wouldn't have the kind of rich intellectual depth, the robust cultural traditions, the thriving Jewish life that we have. If that's all there was in Jewish history, we wouldn't be here today. We wouldn't be alive. And it's not just that we didn't die, it's that, thank God, we have lived and lived and thrived with vibrancy, with intensity, and with creativity. But at the same time, regretfully, very, very regretfully, it's clear that we as a people have experienced suffering as a people nationally on a level unprecedented in human history. We have experienced many tragic events and painful periods over the past millennia, religious persecution, anti-Jewish violence, economic hardship, national dispersion, and sustained systematic annihilation. And this will be the focus of this course, the memory, remembering what these events were and how they are transmitted memory-wise from generation to generation. The next seven lectures will analyze a series of key moments, tragic moments in Jewish history, beginning with next lecture, the destruction of the first temple in Jerusalem in the year 586 BCE, before the Common Era, and culminating in the last two presentations in the story and the after story of the Shoah, of the Holocaust of the 20th century. We don't just remember the happy times. We do, we have holidays. But we also, like one of the six remembrances, Amalek, or the one about Miriam not speaking well about her brother, we also remember the sad times or the negative times. We will explore how they were remembered. How does Jewish culture remember national persecution and national catastrophe? How did and how does Jewish culture shape the memory of these terribly painful events? What are the mechanisms of memory to ensure that they not be forgotten? What are the messages that are being handed down from generation to generation? And we know that it's not just in our heads, but what are the behaviors? What are the doing that we need to do that are fundamentally part of this whole enterprise called memory? In this set of lectures, we will focus particularly on one method of doing, on one method of acting when it comes to the commemoration of Jewish national or social or cultural memory in terms of tragedy, and that is the establishment of commemorative fast days in order to remind us of these events and to think about them deeply. Fast days play two significant roles in our tradition. Classically, in the days of the Talmud, they were meant to stave off a potential impending disaster. So if there's a drought and we're really worried, so the rabbis institute fast days, the goal being to do tshuva, the goal being to somehow repent and to try to get rid of the sin, the assumption being that this event is happening because of a sin, because we're not worthy. If only we could become more worthy, then we could somehow make this go away. And we're going to have a lot to talk about this, particularly in the context of the Holocaust. The second role of fast days is not to try to somehow in the future stop something, but to look at the past and say, oh my God, terrible things happen. And we will analyze them one after another in the next seven lectures, and somehow inspire ourselves, this is the rabbinic perspective, to once again introspect, once again try to better ourselves, and to try to remember the events that happened, and not that make them go away, they don't go away, but to try to help us understand that we need to be better, and so that in the future they should never recur. We will see that the Bible refers to four fast days, this is in our next lecture, that commemorate four tragedies. Most important one being the fast of the ninth day of the Hebrew month of Av, that's the fifth month, perceived of as the fifth month in the Hebrew calendar, a fast day that is designed to commemorate the destruction of both temples. We'll see in the next lecture that both temples are understood to have been destroyed on that day. That is the most significant fast day for tragedy that we have. And we will see that fast days were repeatedly established, one after another, century after century, to commemorate subsequent tragedies that occurred to the Jewish community. But at the same time, and this is going to be the crux of this course, we will also encounter a propensity, very strong propensity, not to establish new fast days, not to establish separate days to mark separate tragedies, but to cluster various tragedies together under one day of commemoration. Once the fast of the ninth of Av becomes the most significant day to commemorate the destruction of the temples, that becomes the most significant day to commemorate all, or almost all, of Jewish destruction and tragedy, whether they occurred on that day or did not occur on that day. So much so that they felt that even the Holocaust should be commemorated on that day. Others, by contrast, felt that new tragedies merit new fast days, new modes of commemoration, and for sure, the Holocaust merits its own separate day of commemoration. It is this tension, should we subsume under this day of the ninth of Av or not, that will be occupying us for the core focus of this series. We will analyze what's the desire to subsume, what's the desire not to subsume, what's to be gained by clustering, what's not to be gained by clustering. I want to conclude this introductory lecture with 3 points. Number one, back to the beginning. The story about the radioactive materials inside the Yucca Mountain in Nevada, with which I began, the challenge of figuring out how later generations will be taught what a current generation determines is important for those later generations to know, highlights how one generation shapes what and how future generations remember. This idea of collective memory or national memory is not passive. Memory is active. The current generation receives a past that was consciously shaped for it by generations that came before us. And in turn, a current generation consciously shapes the kind of past and present that it wants later generations to remember. It's not that we're a vessel and we just remember, or we're told to remember, or now we understand that it means we're told to make whatever this event is to be very important. But we are receiving a conscious decision made by those who came before us, who shaped those events that they're transmitting to us in a way that they want us to remember, and we, accepting that, will make a decision about how we are going to want later generations to remember. It's something very, very active. It's something that's constantly ongoing. Every generation constructs and reconstructs, invents and reinvents, shapes and reshapes the kind of past it wants to transmit to the future. Number two, I've referred to the notion of collective memory. But given the kind of collective memory that we're going to be focusing on in this course, I want to introduce a concept that has recently begun to receive a great deal of scholarly attention, and that is the notion of collective trauma. Collective trauma is becoming popular in the academy, and I bring you an article that was published last year in a journal called Frontiers in Psychology, in 2018, by Gilad Hirschberger. Let's read the first few lines of his article. The term collective trauma refers to the psychological reactions to a traumatic event that affects an entire society. It does not merely reflect an historical fact, the recollection of a terrible event that happened to a group of people. It suggests that the tragedy is represented in the collective memory of the group, and like all forms of memory, it comprises not only a reproduction of the events, to the extent to which it's possible to have an objective understanding of exactly what it is that happened, but much more significant, but also an ongoing reconstruction of the trauma in an attempt to make sense of it. So we have collective memory, but our focus is not just memory in general, national memory in general, but memory of trauma, traumatic memory. And finally, and thirdly, and text number 7, cultures survive cultural trauma by engaging in what is called cultural resilience. The capacity for groups to cope with, to survive this stress, this trauma, and this disruption, something that also relatively recently has begun to get a lot of academic attention. Just the beginning of this article by Andreas Weber that was published in 2018, the first steps toward a text number 7, the first steps toward a theory of resilience were taken some 40 years ago. Rather than focusing on the reasons for people to break down, for species to become extinct, or for populations to disappear, or I would say less extremely, focusing on the sadness and the tragedy and the persecution and the challenge that different peoples, including Jews, have experienced, scholars began to address the ability of individuals and groups to cope with internal and external factors like stress or disruption. And in footnote number 1, there are a ream of sources, secondary literature, on the concept of resilience theory. We are here today, Jews continue to exist well into the 21st century, because classical Jewish culture developed mechanisms to ensure the resilience of the Jewish people. And classically, we will see, and we will come back to this repeatedly, that this was done theologically by continuing to insist upon that no matter how bad it is, and it's bad, and it is bad, and it was bad, no matter how bad it is, somehow Jews still have a relationship to God. Classically, this construct theologically was insisted upon to be central. Jews throughout the ages, modernity is very different. Jews throughout the ages were able to be resilient in the face of trauma because they somehow internalized the message that the leadership of the community spent a lot of time trying to convey, that somehow the covenantal classical construct of the relationship between God and the Jewish people has not been shattered, but has continued to be maintained. Collective or cultural memory, collective or cultural trauma, collective or cultural resilience will be at the core of this presentation. The most well-known and solemn commemorative fast, as I mentioned, that exists in Jewish tradition and the Jewish calendar is that of the 9th of the Hebrew month of Av, which was designated to commemorate the destruction of both temples. It is to these events and to that fast that we will turn our attention to in our next presentation. That's the proof, because bad things happen on bad days. It's a bad day. So that's how you know that it was destroyed on the same day that the first one was destroyed. It doesn't get more ahistorical than this.